poem was written by Jane Kenyon. The title is Otherwise. I got out of bed on two strong legs. Might have been otherwise. I ate cereal, sweet milk, ripe, flawless peach. It might have been otherwise. I took the dog uphill to Birch Wood. It might have been otherwise. All morning, I did the work I love. At noon, I lay down with my mate. It might have been otherwise. We ate dinner together at a table with candlesticks. It might have been otherwise. I slept in a bed in a room with paintings on the walls and planned another day, just like this day. But one day, I know, it will be otherwise. This poem was published in 1996 as part of a collection by Ms. Kenyon titled Otherwise, New and Selected Poems. It was a posthumous publication. Ms. Kenyon died in 1995, age of 48, from leukemia. She was living with her husband, the poet Donald Hall, at their home just north of here in Wilmont, New Hampshire. And Ms. Kenyon was the poet laureate of New Hampshire at the time of her death. Like much of Ms. Kenyon's poetry, this poem of hers needs little interpretation. It's about grace. It's about finding gracious moments in what might be called the profound ordinariness, or if you want to turn it around, the ordinary profundity of life. Such graceful times can at times be amazing. One of the things that makes such times moments of grace is because we know, on some level, that they're only with us for a moment, and then it will be otherwise. Indeed, Jane Kenyon wrote these words knowing that otherwise, in its most ultimate sense, was for her very near at hand. I use the phrase finding gracious moments, but in truth, it is grace more often than not that finds us. Such, in fact, was the case behind the writing of probably the best known commentary, or the best known ode to grace, if you will, which is John Newton's well-known hymn, Amazing Grace. So we're going to move from Jane Kenyon for a moment. We'll come back to her in a little bit. We're going to move from her to Mr. Newton. I'm fascinated when I look at this song, Amazing Grace. I'm fascinated at how it has leaped out of its original context, religious context, into what in which it was first written, to take on something of a universal dimension. It is probably, I didn't research this as thoroughly as I could have, but it is probably the only hymn that you will find in hymnals for both the Southern Baptists and the Unitarian Universalists. And while it is considered a Christian hymn, there's no reference anywhere in it to Jesus or to Christ. In fact, there's not even a reference to God until you get to the fourth verse. And that verse wasn't in the original version that was written by the original author. One of the most enduring recordings of the song was done way back in the day, or what is becoming, at least for me and people of my generation, way back in the day, by Judy Collins, who has no particular religious agenda that I can detect. It became, again, way back when, something of a countercultural ode when Arlo Guthrie sang it at Woodstock and at many of his subsequent concerts. So what is it, then, that gives this song? What is it about this song that gives it its universal appeal to the point that it even finds itself in our current UU hymnal? Well, I'll see what lights I can shed on that, offering my thoughts on how grace can be understood and experienced by religious liberals. The story of how the hymn came to be written is as good a starting point as any, and it's a good story all by itself. Some of you may know parts of it or some of it. It was by the aforementioned John Newton, born in London, 1725. He went to sea with his father at age 11, after his mother had died. And as he continued on with the life at sea and learned seafaring ways, he became, by all accounts, a real wretch. He was not a very nice guy. One story is that his fellow sailors on one of their voyages actually complained to the captain about Newton's prolific and excessive swearing. Try to imagine that. A ship full of sailors upset at one of their shipmates swearing. Guy must have been a world-class cusser. That's about all I can figure out of that. Another story is that he once fell overboard and the crew refused to drop a lifeboat to him. Instead, they threw out a harpoon, which he had to hold on to as they dragged him back to the ship. Like I said, not a nice guy. He was, however, an accomplished enough sailor, but by the time he reached his 20s, he was able to captain ships of his own. He captained slave ships, among other things, transporting captured Africans to America to be sold into slavery. And then, in an account with kind of like Jonah and the whale overtones to it, on one voyage, Newton's ship, of which he was a captain, came into a violent storm that no one on board thought they were going to survive. And as he tried to steer his ship through it, not knowing where he was or where he was going, Newton realized he had come to one of those, to use some 12-step language here, he had come to one of those let go and let God moments. In other words, a moment when he realized his hands and his fate were no longer in his hands, even though I guess he was probably keeping his hands on the ship's wheel, he realized they were no longer on his hands, they were instead in the hands of a power, or powers, or fates, or whatever one wishes to call it, much greater than himself. And all he could do was just let the happenings happen, let life happen, and then see what happened to him. When I read that piece of his story, I was reminded of something I heard a whitewater rafting guide of mine a few years ago, whose raft I was in as we were whipping down a river in southern West Virginia, and as we approached a rather treacherous stretch of water, this guide said in that delightful southern West Virginia drawl of his, "Well, sometimes you just gotta let the river do what it does." I didn't take a whole lot of comfort in those words. At the moment, all I could do was sit there in that raft and let the river do what it does, and the river did what it did, and we made it through. To return to Newton, the ocean and the storm did what it did, and the ship and the crew survived. And Captain Newton had a religious conversion that eventually resulted in him becoming the Reverend John Newton, an Anglican minister with Methodist leanings. And the song he wrote, which is based on that seagoing experience, when you think about it, is very quite literal in places with respect to his experience. "I once was lost, but now I'm found. Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. 'Twas grace that brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home." He knew what that was about, as I say, in a very literal sense. As Reverend Newton, John Newton became a prolific hymn writer up to the time of his death at age 82. And the original title of Amazing Grace, by the way, is not the one that Newton gave it. In accordance with how hymns were titled at that time, the song was first called Faith's Review and Expectation. Doesn't have quite the same ring to it somehow as Amazing Grace, and I cannot imagine Judy Carlins or Arlo Guthrie recording a song called Faith's Review and Expectation. Well, that's an interesting story, I think, and what does it have to do with us here? Us, mostly a bunch of 21st century Unitarian Universalists. Let me touch on a couple of things I think it means for us as religious liberals to live by grace. One is to live with a basically trustful attitude towards life, knowing that we will at times also be betrayed by it. The other is to live with an openness to receiving the unexpected and often undeserved gifts of life that come our way, knowing that we also have to live with many ungiftful life times as well. These two attributes I offer on grace reach across and well beyond any religious beliefs or doctrines. You may or may not believe in God, may or may not believe in a power greater than yourself, and still live by grace in the manner I've just noted. Amazing Grace, to keep that song before us, speaks really to many universal human experiences, which I say transcend the bounds of any religious doctrine. Who hasn't had a time of feeling lost, about a sink with yourself and your world, and then somehow, either by your own efforts or efforts beyond you, things pull back together again? What's lost, now found. It is a universal human experience, at times, to be oblivious or to be blinded to certain aspects of ourselves and our world, and then be awakened to them. was blind, but now I see? Who hasn't had a fearful heart at times? And then, often through the love and care of others, had that fear relieved. And many of us, I would guess, have had life-changing experiences that come upon us and cause us to think or to act or see or perceive in new and different ways for having had those experiences. How precious did that grace appear the hour I first believed or perceived or saw something in a new and a different light for the first time that maybe put my life on a different course, a different track. To pick up on that first point then, to live by grace is to live with a basically trustful attitude towards life, knowing that it will also betray us at times. I continue to come back to the theologian Sam Keynes and his term for this stance, which he calls trustful agnosticism. Think of one of my base points for life, trustful agnosticism. That is to say, the ability to trust and stay in the flow of life, even if we do not know who or what it is that is ultimately directing it. And Keynes' metaphor for this stance, which I know I've often invoked, is the cartoon in which a cat escapes from an attacking dog by running across a pond. And as the cat runs across the water, a series of lily pads keep coming up to meet his feet, and he keeps going. But as soon as he looks down and starts worrying about where the next lily pad will be, that's when he sinks into the water. Sam Keynes' take on this is to say, you can't be graceful, that is, full of grace. You can't be graceful looking at your feet. Trust the happenings. As I say, Keynes calls this trustful agnosticism, since he and I as well do not know just who or what it is that ultimately sustains life, who or what it is that keeps the lily pads coming. He just notes that to live by grace is to walk in and through life, believing that the sustenance will be there. And that is living by grace, whatever one's theology or religious beliefs or spiritual practices may be. I believe then what Sam Keynes says is true. But I also believe what a gentleman named James Hillman says in a book of essays he wrote on trust and betrayal called A Blue Fire. Hillman kind of provides a counterpoint to Keynes, not a refutation, a counterpoint, kind of the yin to the yang. This is Hillman. You cannot have trust without the possibility of betrayal. We are betrayed only where we truly trust, by brothers, sisters, lovers, spouses, not by enemies, not by someone you didn't trust to begin with. Trust has in it the seed of betrayal. Trust and the possibility of betrayal come into the world at the same time. But we must be clear that to live or love only where there is trust, where one cannot be hurt or let down, means really being out of harm's way, and so to be out of real life. Now, it took me a while to get that. First time I read it, I found myself wanting to have an argument with Mr. Hillman, which I sometimes do when I read books, and I'll come to a line that'll stop me for a minute, and I'll stop and try to have this little internal dialogue with the author, even though the author isn't actually available. Found myself doing that as I read those words. I thought, well, what's wrong with always wanting to be out of harm's way? What's wrong with living and loving only where there is trust? And the answer I finally had to give myself, maybe it was Mr. Hillman channeling himself into me, is that, well, there's nothing really wrong with any of it. It's just that life doesn't always work that way. To choose to trust, as Hillman quite correctly points out, is to accept the possibility of betrayal. And to live by grace, then, is to walk through life with a stance of trust, knowing that the walk is not risk-free, but by believing that by grace the journey is still worth taking, it will lead us to wherever and whatever we find our home to be. Well, to close on this point, I never met or knew Jane Kenyon. I only knew her through what little, I must admit, I have read of her work. But I have to believe that at times, on some level, she had to have felt an ultimate kind of betrayal in knowing that her life would be taken from her before she even reached the age of 50. And yet, she could still celebrate, eating cereal with sweet milk and peaches, and walking her dog through a New Hampshire wood. The other piece of grace I'm holding up today is that living by grace means keeping a stance of openness and receptivity to the unexpected and the sometimes undeserved gifts that life can bestow upon us. Right about the time that I discovered the works of Sam Keen, whom, as I've told you before, I finally got to meet and study with for a week last summer, I also discovered the works of another theologian who, like Keen, did some of his early writings against the backdrop of the upheavals of the 1960s and early 70s. This was Mr. Michael Novak. Unlike Dr. Keen, Mr. Novak later shifted to the ranks of the neoconservatives, which is his trip, and I'll leave him to it. But in the early 1970s, Michael Novak wrote a wonderful and timeless book called Ascent of the Mountain, Flight of the Dove. It's long out of print. A very tattered copy remains on my shelf. Try that title again. Ascent of the Mountain, Flight of the Dove. It's Novak's metaphor for the religious or spiritual journey. And it has stayed with me in the nearly 40 years since I first read it. Sometimes, oftentimes, the life journey, the journey of the spirit, is like climbing a mountain. You work at it, probing, asking questions, seeking answers, despairing at some times, hopeful at other times, enlightened at some times, baffled completely at other times. But you keep climbing the mountain. You keep working your way from one level or one landing to another. Maybe sometimes you even have to backtrack when you've been hurt or wounded before you can get any higher again. And then, in the midst of all that climbing, usually when it is least expected, comes the flight of the dove. The sudden moment of inspiration. The sudden sense of the giftfulness of life. The times when we can look up from the climb and out across the terrain say, yes, it's good to be here. It is in such moments of grace that we find our reasons then to go on with the climb. To continue on with the ascent of the mountain in the faith and in the hope that we will again at some point be blessed by the flight of the dove. So I'll close with this. Life both blesses and wounds us. We cannot prevent either one. And more often than not, we don't know when either one is going to appear. We can only hope and trust we have the strength and the fortitude, drawing as well upon the strength and the fortitude of those who love and care us most, to deal with the wounds, while at the same time cultivating the openness to receive the blessings and the times of grace that will come our way. To live by grace is to live with a basic stance of thankfulness and to trust the direction of life we have each and all been given for as long as it is ours to have. I got out of bed. Two strong legs. It might have been otherwise. I ate cereal, sweet milk, ripe, flawless peach. It might have been otherwise. I took the dog uphill to the birch wood. All morning, I did work I love. At noon, I lay down with my mate. It might have been otherwise. We ate dinner together at a table with silver candlesticks. It might have been otherwise. I slept in a room with paintings on the walls and planned for another day. Just like this day. But one day, I know it will be otherwise. Closing hymn, surprise, surprise, number 205, Amazing Grace. Let's sing that together.